This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. Today's show is going to be interesting because, you know, we're at that stage where we've made our New Year's resolutions, and they start weakening a little bit, especially when it comes to diet and eating a healthier diet. Not necessarily weight loss, but you know, what are you doing to help your diet and help your general health? So my guest today is going to be Dr. Charles Cavo. Dr. Cavo is the chief medical officer and co-founder of Pounds Transformation in West Hartford. He's been a guest on our program before, and we want to talk to him a little bit about the evolution of the diet and weight loss, and especially when it comes to something we read about every day, which is Wegovy, Ozempic. What is the best use of those medications to be used judiciously? So he's going to be joining us in the second segment of our program. As always, I'm ready to take questions for Dr. Cavo. So if you want to reach out to me, you can do that at info@alessimd.com. One of the things I take great joy in is our listeners sharing ideas with me, and I thought it was time to really touch on a few of those things. I got a wonderful email from James he was commenting on our program last week about pain, where we had Dr. Lloyd Siberski on, and specifically he would like information on neuropathic pain and peripheral neuropathy. So, James, we're going to get that going in the next couple of shows. I'll spend some time on that topic. Peter reached out to me about what has been called a new medical group, this Sohn Health. If you are regular listeners to this station, Brian Shackman has had them on a couple of times, talking about how private practice physicians have come together to form groups. Now, this is an old concept. Back in the 80s, when individual practice associations were formed, we had one in Eastern Connecticut called Colonial Individual Practice Association. And it's a group of solo practitioners, small groups that come together to really form, to not share income, but to try and share expenses and contracting with big insurance companies. So anyhow, a new group that's available, and there was an article on that in The Current. And Margaret reached out to me, which was an interesting story. She was able to purchase a pewter tray at Goodwill for $12. And what's interesting is the metalsmith's biography was written by Dr. Henry Gans, M.D. So she did some research and shared that with me on Dr. Gans, and just fascinating. Dr. Gans was a hepatologist, so he was a surgeon who specialized in diseases of the liver and led an interesting life. He was born in 1925 in the Netherlands and escaped the German invasion and came to the United States, where he eventually, after finishing medical school in Europe, became board certified here and spent time at the University of Minnesota. And also he spent time at New York Hospital in Cornell. But what was interesting about Dr. Gans was in 1969, he was one of the early transplant surgeons. So we talked about in the past in 1967, right, the first heart transplant. Well, Dr. Gans performed a liver transplant in 1969, and he performed, they were the first two clinical split liver transplantations at New York Hospital Cornell. And but shortly thereafter that, that program was suspended. And the reason was organ rejection, right? So that was the biggest obstacle in transplantation, was how do you suppress the immune response to going against an organ that came from someone else. So it got suspended, but now, you know, liver transplantation is fairly common. So I thank all of you for reaching out to me. It's always a pleasure to get emails and have you share in this program. This day in medicine, January 18th, 1719, Dr. and Sir Samuel Garth died. He was a physician. He died at the age of 58. And he was actually the private physician, personal physician for George I. But what was interesting was in 1699, there was a murder of a woman named Sarah Stout. And it was found that her body was found floating in a body of water. So when they found the body, they assumed that she was murdered, because the body must have been placed in the water after she was murdered. So there was a trial. But the interesting part is Dr. Garth was asked to give expert testimony. And we think that's one of the earliest examples of forensic medicine and the idea of physicians giving testimony in court regarding criminal cases. And we're very familiar with that today. And many physicians, especially pathologists, you know, and how they are able to really work with the legal profession. Today, I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about polio. We're reading a lot about it. There's conversations going on. Is the polio vaccine going to be banned? You know that polio. So I think it's, you know, that polio vaccines are mandated in children. And the reason is, let's go back and look at the history of it a little bit. What is polio? Polio is a highly contagious virus that enters the mouth and the GI tract. So it is orally transmitted. So you'll get it from food and water, usually in unsanitary conditions. So you would get it from the feces of an infected person, less so from cough droplets, but mostly from the feces. So any type you have, anytime you have an unsanitary situation where people cannot wash their hands with warm water. So what happens is the virus gets absorbed in the GI tract, spreads to the lymph nodes, and particularly, so it produces general flu-like symptoms, like any other flu, right? Sore throat, GI upset, this weakness. But the polio virus has a particular propensity to attacking nerve cells in the spinal cord and in the brainstem. And that's where my experience comes in as a neuromuscular specialist, because when it attacks the nervous system, it'll produce a meningitis and, as we all know, paralysis. The paralysis is a result of it attacking specifically what are called the anterior horn cells. These cells are motor. They regulate. They are the cell bodies for motor nerves. So it doesn't affect sensation at all. It only affects your ability to move. And the other illness that affects those anterior horn cells is Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. So these folks, in many cases, look like people who have had ALS, except that half of all the infections occur in children under the age of five. So when we look at it, you're looking at a person who has severe weakness and atrophy of muscles. The bulbar form, the one that goes to the brainstem, will affect the facial muscles. So these are people who will have trouble speaking, trouble swallowing, and digesting. But more commonly, it has affected the limbs in people who have polio. So when we look at that, and today, it's rare that you see it. right? Thanks to vaccines, we've essentially wiped it out. In 2022, the only two countries where it would be endemic were Pakistan and Afghanistan. So the other thing we're concerned about is what's called the post-polio syndrome. When I was at Michigan, we saw a lot of these folks with this. And basically, they're older adults. And right now, today, there are 300,000 Americans still alive who have had polio. Some of them very famous. Francis Ford Coppola, Mia Farrow, again, had relatively mild cases of polio. But the post-polio syndrome is where people, as they become older, start experiencing new weakness. So there was this fear that the polio virus had come back, and it set off a panic in many of these people. What we found was that when the virus attacked these anterior horn cells, they killed a certain number of them, but some existed. But as we age, we lose these cells naturally, as we do many other things. So what was happening was their threshold of cells to move a limb was reduced. And now that they aged, they were developing new weakness. So this is still something going on. Many people, when they think of polio, think of the old iron lung, right? That metal tube. And I know I'm talking to many people. I'm sure many of our listeners remember this well and have lived through this period in their lives. So they would have the iron lung that would change pressure for breathing. Now we use ventilators, so you rarely see an iron lung, except in, you know, basically in museums. But when we get to the vaccine, the history of the vaccine goes back to the 1940s and 50s. Jonas Salk really produced the first inactivated poliovirus that was injected, and the Sabin virus, which was an attenuated oral vaccine, which is the one we use today. There are three forms of poliovirus. Each of these vaccines is trivalent in the sense that it produces antibodies against all of these. Now, these vaccines were tested, have been tested over the years, and have proven to be life-saving for many people. And it's interesting because I think the people who remember it best are the people who lived through that. And obviously, we are a dying breed, to say the least. So with that, now that there's discussion of what is the value of the polio vaccine, I think it's going to be interesting to see how it gets presented. And I thought I'd give everybody some basis and some history behind what has developed over these years, and specifically how we move forward as a country, I think, is going to be absolutely imperative. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to get right back with my guest, Dr. Charles Cavo, and we're discussing diet, exercise, and general health so we can keep going with our New Year's resolutions when they pertain to health and diet. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest once again today, Dr. Charles Cavo. Dr. Cavo is the Chief Medical Officer and co-founder of Pounds Transformation over on LaSalle Road in West Hartford. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Let's talk a little bit. We've got about 5 minutes before the bottom of the hour, so I want to give everybody a little bit of an idea about your background and the, kind of the evolution of Pounds Transformation.
Sure. So back is OBGYN, so I was a resident at University of Connecticut and then private practice for about 15 years over at Grove Hill, which became Starling in New Britain. And really was focused on women's health. And during my time at Starling, my wife, Michelle, who's a physician assistant and very interested in nutrition, she had a concept to start a medical practice, which really just dealt specifically with metabolic health, metabolic medicine, and helping people understand what their body needs through nutrition and lifestyle changes to facilitate more weight loss and improve chronic illnesses like hypertension, diabetes, and whatnot. So as her practice opened with two patients, it very quickly grew to several hundred and then thousands. I stopped doing OB at Starling and was basically hired by Michelle as the chief medical officer for her practice. And then we expanded the practice into Southington and Glastonbury. And our team is all providers with many dietitians. And our concept is really using education and metabolic markers to individualize the care that we offer people when it comes to nutrition and lifestyle changes to improve chronic conditions, which can be cured if people can do a better job understanding them and not relying so much just on medicines to put a Band-Aid on bigger problems. And so now the practice continues to sort of morph. I'm in the process of doing a certification in functional medicine. I think there's a lot to be gained in even better addressing root cause to problems that exist in people's health. And we're implementing those kind of strategies to further push into people's problems and resolving them. So it's been a really interesting ride, fun one at that. And I like sharing our story with people. So thanks for asking.
Why do you think it grew so quickly?
I think people are looking for answers for their health other than as you get older, you get sicker. It doesn't have to be that way. And I think there are a lot of curious people out there that are looking for better answers and better ways. Once they understand where problems might exist, they're willing to fix them and not just rely on medications.
Are most of your patients and people who join your group, are they self-referred or referred by other physicians? How do they come to you? Because I know, I mean, you don't do advertising, you don't have billboards up. So how did people become aware of you?
Yeah, we never did do any advertising, really. We just let the word of mouth kind of get out there. And my background in OBGYN was it facilitated a relationship between Women's Health Connecticut, which is the largest OBGYN group in the state. So we have a partnership with them. We probably have about 400 physicians that refer into our practice, and then people stumble into what we do on the internet. We have social media with Instagram and Facebook. They can find us and learn a bit about us. But the majority of our patients, I would say, are still coming in from referrals from physicians, as well as just seeking us out on the internet.
It's great. It's great. It's a great story. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to get back with my guest, Dr. Charles Cave. We have a lot to talk about. I really want to talk about some of the biomarkers you already mentioned, as well as, you know, better approaches to diet. And also, let's talk a little bit about the GLP-1 drugs, Ozempic, Wegovy, Zepbound, and things such as that. So if you have questions for Dr. Cave, you could reach us at info@alessimd.com, and I'm happy to ask those questions. We're going to be back after a short break. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and my guest today is Dr. Charles Cave, and we are talking about really diet and healthy eating and healthy lifestyles. Charlie, let's talk a little bit about something you talked about with the approach to weight loss and the use of biomarkers, specifically in the philosophy at Pounds Transformation.
Sure. So biomarkers are really, we're looking at blood work. And while we order a large panel of labs to give us some clues and guidance as to why people maybe having the kind of problems that they may be having when it comes to abnormal weight gain or other medical issues, the one that I think is most important for listeners to appreciate and understand is insulin. So that biomarker, insulin, is a great tool to help people understand how insulin works and how they might be able to change their diet in order to control their insulin better. I think a lot of people throw around the insulin resistance without really understanding or appreciating it because it's synonymous with the smoke basically coming out of a window of somebody's health And if you don't appreciate the fact that an insulin level is elevated, you will be well on your way to becoming a pre-diabetic and diabetic in the future. And so it's such a great biomarker and blood value to get and understand and explain to patients, and then hopefully control it through food choices. Another biomarker that we use that's really helpful is uric acid. So uric acid is associated with gout, but what I don't think people really appreciate is how uric acid actually triggers cells to feel as though they're in a starvation state and want to hold on to fat rather than burn it. And it comes from an evolutionary sort of way in which uric acid came to be. And it's a breakdown product, actually, of fructose, which is a sugar. And the higher the uric acid, the more likely it is that you'll have problems, not just with gout, but with controlling your blood pressure and also controlling your weight. So those are just two examples of, like, some of my favorite biomarkers to get that I don't think most people will get through an annual exam.
Can you talk a little bit about the insulin theory and insulin resistance a little bit more? Because I think that's really a prominent issue right now in people's struggle to maintain a healthy weight.
Yeah, sure. So insulin is a hormone. And just because we're looking at insulin, it doesn't mean that you have diabetes. So I could, and often do, tell people that their insulin's high, and they jump right to the idea that they're a diabetic. And they're totally different values that we would look at to make a diagnosis of insulin resistance versus being a diabetic. So insulin resistance is really a misnomer. When we look at insulin and find people with elevated levels of insulin, which is very common, it has to do with how they're tolerating carbohydrates. And if your insulin level is high, it most likely suggests that your carbohydrate tolerance is not being, it's not well controlled. And whatever diet the person might be on is having too many carbohydrates in their diet, resulting in this increase in insulin. And the problem with high insulin, which is a hormone, it is the most powerful fat gaining hormone or growth hormone that anybody secretes. And the only times really that insulin should be elevated are the two P's of life, puberty and pregnancy, when growth is going on. But unfortunately, like these days with all the different kinds of carbohydrates and ultra processed foods that are out there, we're seeing a lot of high insulin with the amount of carbohydrates people are eating. And I know, Tony, that sometimes people think, oh, this is, you know, I'm just going to have to give up all my carbohydrates. And that's totally not true. What you do have to do is appreciate how many grams of carbohydrates your body can tolerate in the course of a day or a week before you're producing excess insulin, which is going to cause excess weight and a whole lot of other excess chronic conditions that we see.
You mentioned ultra-processed foods and other foods. Are there certain carbohydrates that are better than others?
So kind of a loaded question, because sometimes you give people the advice that there are better carbs than others, and next thing you know, they might be exceeding their carbohydrate threshold.
Sure.
because they're eating good carbohydrates. So, and it's not to say carbohydrates are bad by any means, but yes, I do think that there are certain carbohydrates, like carbohydrates from starches and grains and that kind of thing, which could be more beneficial than obviously carbohydrates that are going to be very quickly absorbed as sugar and hit your bloodstream quickly and cause a rapid rise of insulin, which comes from things like sugar and fructose, juices and these kind of things. So, yeah, I think that people can have healthier carbs that are blunted with fiber and come from natural sources. But at the same time, for somebody that's having significant insulin resistance, even those sometimes need to be taken into account and reduced to some extent.
What makes the ultra-processed foods so bad? I mean, we have processed foods. We know that. I mean, that's what helps food stay longer and last longer. But these ultra-processed foods, and what comes to mind are chips and things such as that. Is it because those carbohydrates or those foods are metabolized differently?
I think they're metabolized differently for sure. I think ultra-processed foods are made in labs, so our bodies were never really designed to understand what they are anyways. And they usually are also geared to sort of trick ourselves or trick a body into having even a bigger appetite and want to eat more. And there are certainly a lot of chronic conditions that stem from how much ultra-processed foods have entered our food system. And I think what we're going to see in the upcoming years are people will become more curious about understanding how foods are processed and understanding that you can eat certain foods and they actually make you more hungry despite the fact they're the same calorie as a more organic food or a whole food.
One of the things that we always hear about, and I had professed this certainly in the past, is calories in, calories out, right? You took in, it's just a balance sheet. You took in so many calories, are you burning that number of calories? Does that still hold true to some extent, or has that gone the way of the Model T?
I definitely think there's a lot of utility in understanding that idea of calories in and calories out. So you definitely need to pay attention to how many calories you're eating if you're interested in losing weight. That being said, it's definitely not just calories in and calories out. Plenty of people out there are on a very low calorie diet and not seeing their weight change at all. So there's also now, I think, many more people interested in lifestyle and understanding how lifestyle might impact weight loss and weight gain, and certainly the macronutrient composition and understanding proteins, fats, and carbohydrates and how they make up the diet and what kind of hormones they may trigger. I mean, I think now with the drugs that have come out, looking at how they influence weight, these are all hormones. The Ozempic and Wegovy, Mounjaro, Zepbound, they're hormones and peptides. And so I think in the upcoming years, people are going to start appreciating that, yes, calories are definitely important when approaching ways in which to lose weight, but equally as important will be understanding the role that hormones, sleep, exercise, activity, lifestyle, all these things are implicated when you're thinking about what it takes to lose weight in a healthy sort of manner.
Is there, I get the feeling that what you're professing is more personalized medicine, that not everybody is going to respond to the same diet. So, and we've seen this before. People have these kind of generic diets and things such as that. But am I correct in thinking that way, that diet is kind of personalized medicine?
It's really personalized medicine, and I think people are becoming more aware of that too. I can't tell you how many husband and wives we have come in and, you know, somebody is upset because they're eating the same thing and one person is doing really well and the other person's actually seeing their weight go up. And the question is, why is that? And I believe that we're going to get to a place sooner rather than later where people understand there is no best diet. The only best diet is what's going to be sustainable and works for the individual. And I think my other hope is that we start to ditch the term diet. I think talking about nutritional changes that promote health and wellness for an individual is so much more of a framework that people would be willing to live with, because diet just seems so restrictive. But when you start to understand biomarkers, blood work, your metabolism, and personalized nutritional changes that you could make to promote changes in your health and in your weight, it just seems more sustainable to me. So, personalized nutritional changes is really the space that we operate in.
Let me switch gears a little bit. And we've talked about carbohydrates, but let's talk about fats. We've heard about this before, right, with Atkins and South Beach or whatever. I think I'm correct in those. Yet, by the same token, we want to restrict fats because many of us are developing hypercholesterolemia, and we're taught that fats are not that good. So can we talk a little bit about fat metabolism and how that plays a role in nutrition?
Sure. So, yeah, fat is a very tricky subject, I think, still in nutrition, but I believe that more and more people are starting to appreciate that saturated fats, which were thought to be associated with heart disease. I think the those reins are coming off saturated fats, and I think people are appreciating the fact that saturated fats might not be as bad as people once thought they were. So what about fats do I like in a person's way in which they approach their nutrition? For the majority of our patients, there's so many people that have an issue with their insulin. So they're secreting too much insulin. And we know that carbohydrates cause increases in insulin. That leaves us with two other macronutrients to play around with in a person's diet. One would be proteins, which people just don't eat enough of, if you ask me. And the other one are fats. And you can certainly use fats in a person's diet, fully aware that insulin will not be secreted by consuming fat. In fact, things like butter, which is a saturated fat, will cause an increase in butyrate. And we know now that butyrate is actually a pretty nice byproduct because of what it does to a person's GLP, which is the hormone in Ozempic, and that causes satiety. So you can use fats for different biohacks or changes in a person's metabolism and control the insulin. We will use oftentimes approaches with ketogenic plans in people that are very insulin resistant or type 2 diabetics. The type 2 diabetics now, they can be approached as far as management strategies with very low carbohydrate plans. And a ketogenic diet is using fats basically for fuel and metabolizing fats for the fuel. And when you metabolize a fat for fuel, you're breaking the fat down and getting a ketone, which is called beta-hydroxybutyrate, to serve as the main fuel source for a body rather than relying on glucose. And then the other thing that I think is really interesting is how people associate fats and fat intake with increases in cholesterol, which also is not necessarily true for many, many people. And it's such an easy way to sort of test to see whether or not you're going down the wrong rabbit hole by just simply changing the way a person's approaching their macronutrients and getting some blood work 3 or 4 months later to see what happened to somebody's cholesterol. One of my colleagues that is that works with me, I'm on the board for a company called RX Sugar, which is all about allulose. And Nick Norwitz, who's a very well sort of featured person on YouTube, and he right now is finishing up his degree at Harvard in medicine after doing his PhD at Oxford. He is known for his Oreo diet on YouTube and his egg diet on YouTube. And Nick ate, I want to say 700.
Give me the Oreo diet right away.
The Oreo diet. Yeah. Have you heard of that?
No, but I love Oreos. Who doesn't?
Nick proved there are certain people that respond in different ways to fat-fueled diet. And so in any case, Nick understands physiology really well, and he proved that he could reduce his cholesterol just as much by eating Oreos as he could by taking a cholesterol-lowering medicine. And it's really important to tell people that, look, by no means am I saying that Oreos are, was Nick proving that Oreos are better than statins when it comes to taking care of cholesterol and reducing risk. But I think what he does do in that is raises the question of curiosity with regards to how we've gone and demonized fats, and it's not really fats that causes the change in cholesterol panels. A lot of times it's a non-modifiable risk factor when it comes to the way genes are expressed. And a lot of times the cholesterol problems that people are dealing with has to do with the elevated insulin, which influences fat trafficking, which is cholesterol. But very rarely is a cholesterol going to be increased from eating healthy fats. So I'm glad you asked that question. If you're eating fats, they can be a really good tool to control appetite, as long as they're healthy and somebody's watching what's going on with biomarkers. But I feel bad that people still come in worried about how many eggs they're eating, when in fact that's a great source of nutrition.
Well, you got to my next question right away, and that is, okay, what are the healthy fats? Because we're told to stay away from red meat, right, because of colon cancer. So what do you consider healthy fats? You already mentioned eggs. What else is there?
Sure. So eggs, certainly a healthy fat. I think that having fish that has very healthy fats, lean meats, fine. Chicken, no problem. Red meat, I don't really think there's a problem with that. I like organic grass-fed red meat better than some of the other maybe more processed meats. But I think that we are getting into a place where healthy fats, like the ones I just mentioned, would be mainstay sort of dietary needs. I think that cooking, not in canola oil or seed oils, but using avocado oil, using olive oil, I think using butter, lard, these things are much better than what we've been looking at in the past.
How about fruit? I mean, people say, well, it's fruit, it's healthy, but obviously there's sugar in that, whether it be natural or not. Are you a proponent of fruits?
So fruit is, I think, is a very good food. It's Mother Nature's candy, so there is some fructose in fruit, but it also comes in with plenty of water, fiber, vitamins, and micronutrients. And so I think fruit is a fantastic part of a well-balanced diet. That being said, again, if you look at some people's biomarkers and you recognize that there's a large amount of insulin being produced, or somebody already has blood sugar problems, or somebody has high uric acid levels, I think a conversation should be had with regards to how much fruit a person's having, what kind of fruit they're having, and how they're having it. So if you drink fruit juice, for example, and you pull out the fiber that would have blunted how rapidly the fructose would have entered the bloodstream, that could be really problematic for people that have insulin issues. So I think fruit is a very good part of a diet. I guess I would say I'm an advocate of people having fruit. However, if somebody's having issues, like I mentioned, with their blood work, I think we have to be careful with how much we give the dose of fruit, and even maybe what time the fruit's given. Like if somebody loves fruit, it might be better to have that fruit earlier on in the day so they can exercise off the sugar that comes in with it, versus having fruit late at night when you go to sleep and then you have to have the hormones like insulin work out the elevated blood sugar, which is going to make you gain weight.
How about cheese and dairy? How does that fit into a healthier diet?
Yep. So GI issues sometimes can cause people to want to maybe take some of the dairy out of their diet. It can sometimes be a bit inflammatory for somebody who's dealing with some GI issues. So that might be one of the first foods that we try to eliminate to see if GI issues don't resolve. But aside from that, I think dairy is a very effective food source for people. And the cheeses, say, I would say the same thing. We have plenty of patients that swap their sort of processed bars and what they might have been having as far as maybe granola, and use cheese to control their appetite. It's a saturated fat, and we generally don't see any problems with that when it comes to what people are concerned about, which is cholesterol.
Exercise seems to be part of a healthy diet. I mean, I realize it's not something you're taking in, but what do you advocate in terms of exercise for people?
So exercise, no doubt about it. I think it's probably one of the most important medicines that somebody could take next to sleep. So definitely an advocate for exercise. However, I think that when people look at exercise and why they're doing it, I sometimes worry that people are doing it to lose weight. And I don't think exercise is something that necessarily promotes and facilitates weight loss as much as changes in nutrition and lifestyle. Exercise is amazing when it comes to sustaining the weight that's been lost in people. So if you're on a medication these days like Ozempic or Wegovy and you're not exercising, you come off of those medicines, it's much less likely that you're going to sustain your weight loss versus people that are exercising. So I think exercise plays a fantastic role in helping people get healthier, but not necessarily in promoting weight loss, if that makes sense. I know a lot of people look at how many calories they've burned on a device that they're wearing, and those devices are usually very erroneous with the information they're giving and overestimate how many calories you're burning. And going back to that question that you asked, is it all about calories in, calories out? I mean, even if you were burning 500 calories in a brisk walk or something to that extent, it really won't contribute much at all when it comes to weight loss. Certainly many other health benefits from exercise, but I don't think you have to really hit the gym and go exercise as part of a routine to lose weight.
Charlie, in our last minute, what's one message we want to get across to everybody today?
I would say that the message people need to hear is be curious about your lab work, ask for an insulin level, understand that you don't necessarily need a perfect diet as much as you need nutritional changes that are specific for you, and most likely, chronic conditions, you'll either prevent them or resolve them.
Charlie, thank you. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for everything you do over at Pounds Transformation. If people are interested in reaching out to Dr. Cavo, the phone number is 860-906-1289, or you can go to poundstransformation.com. Charlie, thanks again.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on the show.
All right, we're going to take a short break. They're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back to wrap things up. One thing I wanted to mention, you're hearing a lot about masks being mandated over at Yale New Haven Health among its staff. That's a good sign that it may be time to carry a mask and wear a mask when you're in crowded surroundings during this flu and COVID season. Many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Korser, has been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast, and you could download that free at odyssey.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.